The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 15th of January, 2021. On the podcast today, Tim Watts, CEO of Shield Therapeutics, underlined some of the highlights in their business and trading update. Also on the podcast, Russ Mould, investment director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about U.S. stimulus, COVID stats, and markets looking forward. Plus, companies mentioned there are Whitbread and TUI. Also on the podcast, at the end of the interviews, I have two lists for you. Very important lists. These are the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most read RNSs too. By the way, these are important because people following these companies, you know, it's a measure of money flow. They're interested in these companies. They're investing in them. Why? You will check them out yourself. But that's the list right there. And also on the front page at voxmarkets.co.uk, there's lots of other content. Door signs exclusivity agreement for Lake Vannen Wind Farm. That's one there. There's one on Shield Therapeutics. There's an article on BWA Group. What else? Alien Metals. And of course, at the top there is our COVID-19 index. And it's top today. It's been falling for a couple of days. Fusion Antibodies, up 13% of 130. Biggest faller there is Silence Therapeutics. That's down 2.64% to 516. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Tim Watts, CEO of Shield Therapeutics. STX is a ticker. Tim, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much, Justin. Good morning.
Good morning as well. I know you've got a very comprehensive update there, a business and trading update, and we'll dig into the highlights of that in a bit. Before we do, as always, Tim, if someone is listening right now and maybe they've never heard of you or they're vaguely familiar, just summarise the business if you could, please.
Okay, so Shield is a company that has developed an oral product for the treatment of iron deficiency. It's called, it's got a brand name of Ferracru in Europe, Accrufer in the US. And we believe that this is an oral product which has advantages over both the existing oral salt products which are out there, but also over the intravenous iron therapies that are often used when the existing oral products fail. So we think we have a great opportunity with this product. We have already licensed it to Norgine in Europe for commercialization and to a company called ASK Pharm in China to finish off the development for us and then commercialize it. And we are now contemplating how to launch the product in the US.
Excellent stuff. Okay, and we'll get into that in a bit. Let's start off with, you broke a nice bit of highlights down here into operational, financial. Let's get into financial first, because everyone likes to know about the numbers, the figures, the cash. What's happening here, Tim?
Yeah. Okay, so these are unaudited numbers, but we expect our revenues for 2020 to be £9.4 million. 8.7 of that arises from the upfront payment we received earlier in 2020 from ASK Pharm, the Chinese partner, when we signed the license deal with them. The remaining 0.7 million are the unaudited royalties from Norgine, and we're fairly confident with that number, but we haven't yet received, and we wouldn't have expected to receive by now, the royalty statement for 2020 from Norgine, but we think it's going to be in the region of 0.7 million. Mm-hmm. So that's the revenue. And then in terms of cash, we ended 2020 with 2.9 million in the bank. And if I can just remind everybody that in December, we agreed with two of our shareholders that they would make loan facilities available to us so that if necessary, and if we don't receive any more cash, any upfronts, for example, from anybody else, these loan facilities would allow us to keep going until the end of 2021. So it's given us the sort of the backstop and the reassurance, if you like, for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's go through operation. Let's leave the US to last. I know a lot of people are looking at that keenly. So let's go through the operational, if you could, Tim.
Yeah, okay. So coming back to the European royalties, Ferrocrew packs in the UK and Germany, which are the main markets which the product is launched in at the moment. So the pack volumes in 2020 increased by around 70% over 2019. Which we think is a pretty good performance, and particularly when you bear in mind that it's been an incredibly disruptive year with the COVID pandemic, and which has meant that the sales reps in for Norgine, for that matter, all pharmaceutical companies, have not been able to visit doctors to promote products. Clearly, there's much more reliance now on online and so on, but it's obviously been a substantial hiatus. So. Overall, we think a growth of 70% in volumes, is a pretty good performance and encouraging for the future. The next area we've highlighted is China, where our partner ASK there. We know the product isn't approved, and ASK have been working with the Chinese authorities to define what further clinical studies are needed. And the conclusion is that, almost certain, yet to be finally confirmed, is that just one further phase three study will be needed in China. It could be a 12-week study in 120 patients suffering from inflammatory bowel disease. And we think that that could be conducted reasonably quickly, and that hopefully will lead to an approval of the product in China in 2023, which would bring in a milestone payment from ASK to us of $11.4 million. Mm-hmm. We've also progressed the pediatric study. Now, the pediatric study is a requirement of both the European and the US authorities on approval. The product right now is approved for use in adults, but both authorities require us to see if the product works and is safe in children. For small children, you need to have a liquid presentation rather than a capsule. So we've developed the liquid, and we've conducted through the summer and autumn, we've conducted the first stage of the study, which is to test that the liquid formulation is equivalent to the capsule. And the final study results from that will be available by the end of the first quarter, but the indicative results suggest that everything's okay. And so we should be in a position to start the main study in children in the middle of 2021. And that's a study that'll probably go through 2022 and into 23, and it's going to cost us something in the region of £4 to £5 million over the next couple of years. And then a couple of other quick points. Everybody remember that we had to reanalyze the head-to-head study earlier in the year. I'd just like to remind people that the results of the reanalysis that we published in August were really very positive, particularly in terms of the ability of Accrufer to sustain hemoglobin levels in patients over the long term. And the other point I'll just highlight is the defense of our intellectual a defense of the patent challenge. Two of our patents in Europe were challenged by Teva, and we put up a strong defense for those. And actually, earlier this year, we were delighted when Teva withdrew their challenges. So that essentially clears our patent position out to 2035, which is obviously great news.
Yeah. Okay. And let's take in the US then. What's happening there, Tim?
Okay. So, and just to remind people, in December we said that we are still looking at license opportunities, but we're also contemplating launching Accrufer ourselves in the US. The first point to say is that we have now manufactured the launch stocks. I think we said earlier that we would be doing that. We've manufactured them. There's a few technical completion points still needed. For example, making sure that the packs could be tracked if necessary, if there was ever a need to recall. But we should be in a position, if necessary, to ship the launch stocks to the US as early as mid to late February. Mm-hmm. So whichever route we go down, we should have the launch stocks available. We are still talking to several companies about out-licensing options. But as we said in December, we're also looking at, could we launch this product ourselves? Now, in order to do that, clearly our team in the UK doesn't have expertise in the US, so we've brought on board four highly experienced managers, US commercial, pharmaceutical commercial managers, And they are building up for us detailed preparations of, if we do decide to launch the product ourselves, how would we go about it? And so they're covering all the aspects that are needed. So, for example, the supply chain from Europe into the States and into pharmacies all around the States. How do we do that? Which logistics providers do we need to work with? Mm-hmm. We're doing market research to make sure that we really understand the messaging that's needed, and how to pitch the pricing. And on pricing, how do you address the insurance companies? Of course, it's a heavily privatized pharmaceutical market. So how do you approach the insurance companies who are paying for the products and make sure you get the positioning and get onto their formularies so that doctors can prescribe to patients the ACCRUFeR? Yeah. They're looking at branding. Who do we use as marketing agencies? We're looking at the medical affairs. How do you talk to key opinion leaders about the science and why there are benefits from ACCRUFeR? We're looking at Salesforce. How do we set up a Salesforce in the US? Do we recruit sales reps ourselves, or do we use a contract sales organization to provide us with reps? So very comprehensive planning is going on, and we should reach some conclusions on that over the next few weeks. And we're also contemplating how would we finance such a launch. We've indicated that we think that we would need $30 to $40 million to get the group to the point of breaking even on a cash flow basis. So what's the best way of financing that? So taking all of those things, I believe that sometime in the next couple of months, we will reach a decision point and we'll be able to give clarity.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Okay, Tim, well, one final thing, or three final things, you say. If someone's listening to this, likes the sound of the progress you're making, but are not yet following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add Shield Therapeutics to their watch list, please.
Well, I think we've got a very good product. We've got clinical studies which show that it is well tolerated, it's effective, and when you compare it with the gold standard today, which is the intravenous, we think we've got some clear advantages over that product. I would suggest today also that there is substantial upside from the US, and if I can go on from that into really just a brief discussion about the share price. I mean, I guess it wasn't entirely surprising that when we announced in December that we would not do a license deal during 2020, that there was a sell-off in our shares. That's understandable. Mm-hmm. What I think I find more difficult to understand is the extent to the sell-off. And today's share price of around 55 pence, valuation of £70 million. I mean, that is covered by the Europe and China deals. If you evaluate those over a 15-year period, you know that they sustain the value of 70 million. And so I'm a little bit surprised that investors are, if you like, staying clear of our stock when we will get the product onto the market in the US. It'll either come through a license deal, in which case maybe the shares are going to go back to at least the average of £1.15 to £1.20, where they were for most of last year, and probably higher than that for a license deal. And if we do launch the product ourselves, then you know one can anticipate that should bring in much more profit to the company, and therefore should generate even more value. And if you're not invested, you could miss out on that re-rating when that comes through. And if your reason for not investing is because you think you might get diluted in a fundraise, well, you know, if the share price is going to potentially double or even more, would you take that less a bit of dilution, or would you rather not be invested? And so I don't quite understand at the moment why the share price is where it is.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous, Tim. Good to chat to you as always, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell. You're up, Russ?
Yeah, I'm well, Justin. You okay?
Yeah, all good. And it's good. You know, as far as the market's concerned, it's hard to know. This thing, I'm doing a video on the weekend, and I always look at things that I saw yesterday. I don't know if you saw this, that holiday bookings above over 50s is going up.
Gone through the roof,
yes.
Haven't they? Yeah, I saw that. There's one couple who booked five coach holidays or something, I think, bless them.
Yeah, coach holidays, I don't see the attraction in that. But but I suppose the overall sentiment is that the headline I was reading on the BBC actually is looking forward. And this is a stock market. And I was looking at the last time, and TUI is obviously the biggest operator listed, and if you look at their share price, the time to buy was basically just or around about November the 9th was when the vaccine day, when Pfizer came out with the vaccine. Yeah, because then if you look into coach journeys and use that analogy, it was a coach in a tunnel then, and there was no end to the tunnel. But that vaccine day, I mean, the share price of TUI shot up on that day and broke what's called a 200-day moving average, and it came back a bit. But if you look at that was, and we had no goal in sight then for how many people were going to get a vaccine by what time or what time period, but that was almost looking forward about 12 months or 6 to 12 months, that. So it's hard to know with stock markets. I know they don't price in crashes because sometimes they can't see it happening, but if everything goes to plan, stock markets are forward looking. That's why people often question why the market's doing well when the economy's in the hole, isn't it, really?
Yeah, and if you look, Whitbread, which owns Premier Inn, and he's one of the country's biggest hoteliers, and he owns Brewer's Fair and Beefeater, I think, one or two of the restaurants. Its shares are also up 50% to the dot since Pfizer Monday, and it's exactly the same reason. You know, occupancy went down from September to October to November because of increased spread of the virus, because of the November lockdown in England. So not surprisingly, you know, travel was restricted to essential business. And I'm sure you'll see the same again for the quarter ending in February. And just looking at the company, it's forecast to have £773 million of revenues in the year to February 2021 and a pre-tax loss of £775 million. And so, you know, anybody looking at that statically would be thinking, well, why are the shares up 50% in 3 months, for goodness sake? And you've answered it. It's because the market is looking to things getting better. Now, there will inevitably be some lumps and bumps along the road. I can't imagine things are going to go with a vaccination program in a straight line, or indeed the spread of the virus or the containment of the virus. But at some stage, you would like to think that we will be permitted to get out and feel safe to get out. And I think that example of yours of people booking holidays, I know there's a lot of discussion of, oh, it's all going to be different. People aren't going to want to go anywhere. I think personally, people would be desperate to go somewhere. Yeah. And I think you'll certainly see an initial rush and outpour. How things change thereafter, we'll have to see. But I think personally, I wouldn't want to say things will never be the same again, because that's generally not, you know. I remember people saying that air travel would never be the same again after 9/11.
I was going to say the same thing.
For that to recover.
Yeah. There's a CEO of one of the big airlines in America, and he said, listen, behaviour changes very quickly. And exactly, people didn't understand going near planes after 9/11, and then all of a sudden there's changes, and you realise, you know, you revert to mean pretty much. People want to go on holidays. Like I said, my wife is looking to book every holiday possible. calm down. I haven't got much holiday time. You know, but and also just to go out to a restaurant, you know, and have a meal or something, and just do normal stuff.
Just to see your friends. Yeah, exactly. You and I are lucky. We're working. We're getting paid. You know, we've not been furloughed, so in that respect, our economic circumstances are quite blessed. Yeah. But you would like to, I mean, unemployment thankfully hasn't gone up that much yet. You know, if we get through this and it's kept at sort of 4 or 5% range, that again will hopefully after that there'll be fresh jobs created. Mm-hmm. So you would like to think that there will be some pent up demand out there as people want to and are able to get out and do a little bit of spending. And if you have been lucky enough to keep your job, I'm pretty sure your commuting spend's gone through the floor. I know your heating bill's gone up a little bit, and your broadband bill might have done, but overall, I think you're probably going to be better off than you would have been.
And everyone's sort of focused on this target, the vaccination target, and I've been looking, keeping a keen eye on hospital admissions, because that's why we're locked down. People understand.
It is.
I mean, people confuse herd immunity with us being locked down. We don't need herd immunity to unlock the economy. We just need to ease up the pressure on the NHS. Once they can go back to normality, then and people are vaccinated. And I was looking at the stats, and I did a video on this, and 80% of people in hospital beds or hospital admissions in the last week were above 75 years of age.
I can believe it.
Yeah, and a big chunk of that was above 80 and 85. So once those people are vaccinated, then I think, you know, because most people below that don't need hospitalisation, you know, so that will make a big thing. And it is impressive now. They've done close to 3 million vaccinations, and apparently the rollout is going faster, the ramp-up is going quicker. So I think we could be in a... And if you see now, some of the case infections are coming down. I genuinely think by the end of this month, even within 2 weeks, it'll be a lot different story. I think it'll be a lot more positive, you know?
Fingers crossed. I attended a JP Morgan Asset Management webinar with their chief strategist, Karen Ward, earlier on in the week, and they pulled up a stat just saying that of the UK population, those who are over 70, 13% of the people, 50% of the hospitalizations, and 84% of deaths.
Yeah.
So I think that backs up your point. They're the people that you've got to protect, because that will begin to ease the pressure on the health service. And, you know, I'm 50, rising 52. And, you know, even in the 50 to 69s, you're looking at 24% of the population, 30% of hospitalizations, and 15% of deaths. So, you know, again, the odds, I would like to think, are pretty much in my favor. I've gone dry and veggie for January, so a bit of weight drops off as well, which will hopefully help. But yeah, if you're under 30, a third of the population, 3% of hospitalizations, and 0.something% of deaths. So is, you know, for the younger listeners out there, is clearly very encouraging. I'm sure that people will say, well, actually, they're the ones who've been out, you know, they're capable of spreading it further because they're out and about. But, you know, again, once those who are vulnerable have been shielded and being helped, then I think hopefully those people can get out and about a little bit more, because in the end, they want to go out and enjoy their lives, get their education, get their jobs going, get their careers going. So, you know, it's just as important for them that we get this going for many, many reasons, not just financial health, but mental and physical and financial health as well.
Yeah. But the one thing I'm worried about is that we see these figures peaking out now, and people sort of relax a bit more, and that's what we don't need, you know, because I understand some people still fail to understand that while they won't be hospitalised, you know, your friend's nan, for example, may die from it.
That's the thing,
and that's where hospital beds are being taken up. But looking forward, I saw pictures of Los Angeles yesterday. It looks dreadful. I mean, the amount of homeless, it's really a hot spot for COVID thing. Wow. I notice now they're going to handle on. I mean, didn't Biden come up with some stimulus today?
Or 1.9 trillion stimulus, of which, and I've got the numbers written down. Actually, look, we'll have it. Having been, though, the bill itself is thousands of pages, so somebody's been busy putting that together very quickly.
Yeah.
But I mean, thankfully, the Pinko paper, the FT, picked out the key points. I didn't have to read the whole thing. But there was $50 billion set aside for COVID-19 testing alone. And then there are extra $1,400 checks for adults and children who's are under a certain income threshold. There's been $170 billion at education, increased unemployment benefits, $350 billion for state and local aid. So, you know, it's a big. I mean, you got $2.2 trillion last April, you got $900 billion in December, you got another $1.9 now. I mean, intriguingly, the US market's showing flat to down on Friday. Yeah. I guess just because it's the classic market. Again, markets have looked forward. Biden's talked about it.
Yeah.
They kind of knew it was coming. So they think, okay, well, that's all well and good. You know, well, what's coming next kind of thing. But, you know, lots and lots of money is being thrown at this problem. And I think they will continue to throw money at it. I mean, the one thing that's probably surprised me more than anything else, well, apart from Bitcoin going bananas, is that the gold price hasn't been stronger, because clearly the magic money tree is being shaken vigorously, and governments will continue to shake it for a very, very long time to come. And I was intrigued that there was that article in the FT yesterday that was an internal Bank of England survey done, which basically said to them, we're not completely sure you've got a handle on QE and how it's going to work and how you're going to get out of it. And it also said very nakedly, everybody that we've interviewed now basically thinks you're not doing it to necessarily help the economy, you're doing it to bail out the government and keep borrowing costs low, because without that, there'd be a massive problem. So what they're effectively saying is the government issues the bonds to fund all the spending, and then the Bank of England buys them back.
Mm.
Which I think in the US, now that you've got Powell as chairman and his predecessor of the Fed, at the Fed, Janet Yellen, is now Treasury Secretary, well, Powell can issue it and Yellen can buy it back and eat their own cooking together. But, you know, again, in terms of monetization, I mean, that is naked monetization of debt. Yeah. And I think that's one of the reasons why the dollar's been so weak for the last 3 or 6 months.
Yeah. And so, Yeah, looking at the gold price there, it's just consolidated. Now, there's been this argument between the old, I suppose, the older sort of investors and saying gold is good, but Bitcoin has outperformed it. It's a bit more volatile, of course.
Bitcoin's beaten it hands flat. I mean, it's gold's done well, but Bitcoin's just, what is it? Well, I think a year ago it was about $7,000, wasn't it? And it's 38 or something now.
Yeah, Yeah, just it's, do you know what's annoying? I bought some Bitcoin, like, literally.
I remember you telling me.
And I was, and I did about three videos on why I think it's going higher, and just a general thing about, you know, it is an asset now. If people call it an asset and it's doing well and it's outperforming other assets, people will want it as an asset. They want it as an investment. They want to earn money, and that's it. It's self-fulfilling, regardless of where. Do you know what? I was so, I couldn't, the FCA, I was talking about Bitcoin the other day, and I couldn't believe how old and like dinosaur-like they were talking about it, saying it's not real, it's got no intrinsic value. I thought, well, gold is just a rock or, you know, a mineral or coming from the ground. People years ago didn't think that was anything. And I said, and he said, no, it's got to be intrinsic value, it's got to be real. And I thought, why are you sounding so old, fella? I bet his pensions invest in something like solar power, which is the sun. I thought, well, how do you touch that then? You can't touch the sun, but you make money from it. And so if you can make money from it and if people want to invest in it, it's self-fueling. It becomes something. Like I said, if you fancy a bit of art, and I don't like, it depends how much you want to pay for it.
I mean, one of my brothers-in-law, he's a second-hand book specialist, and that's how he makes his money. The antique, you know, but some people will look, well, it's just a piece of paper. What's the point in that? Whereas some people, well, you know, if you want to buy any, I'm a big James Bond fan. There's a specialist book dealer in Tunbridge Wells that is particularly strong on James Bond books. And if you want to buy a signed copy by Ian Fleming, first edition of Casino Royale from 1953, £95,000 for you, Justin.
Wow.
Now, some people would look at the book and think, well, it's a piece of paper with a jacket. Well, I mean, what can I do with that? It's not going to generate you any cash, is it? It's not going to have any intrinsic value, barring about a couple of pence of the paper, but it's signed. The point there is, and I think this dates back to why some people are bullish on Bitcoin, is there aren't going to be any more first editions of Casino Royale, particularly one signed by Ian Fleming.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Relative to how much money is being created out of thin air or debt is being added to the economy. And Bitcoin, you know, the old gig is, it's limited at 21 million bitcoins and there's 18.6 million in issue already. Mm-hmm. And the mining process is getting tiring and expensive. And by 2040, they'll have all been mined and that's it. Mm-hmm. So relative to the rampant money creation we're seeing, that's one of the reasons why hard money advocates, sound money advocates, are latching onto Bitcoin, because there is finite supply there. There is, in theory, infinite supply of paper money. As Nelson Bunker Hunt said when he failed to try and corner the silver market in the late 70s, he said, quote, almost anything's better than paper money because any fool can run a printing press.
And that's
where you get onto, you know, gold, that was silver, Bitcoin, whatever.
Exactly. I mean, that's one of the big arguments, the Bitcoiners, you know, all the time saying, if you look at fiat money, for example, and they say it works on a basis of trust. But, you know, the banks are completely, all the time, you know, diluting that trust by issuing more money. And so, like I said, in the 80s, I think I did this, look at this before, but in the 80s, 40 grand is now worth about 10 grand buying power.
That's the thing.
And so it's, you know, you can't trust that. And that's why I say Bitcoin works off a trustless society, because it's all about edges and stuff, and it's very secure. I mean, you know, people obviously get their accounts hacked. That's to do with the platform they're on. But Bitcoin itself, the technology blockchain, is very secure. It's never been hacked, and so when it's been more than 10 years now, so you could say it sort of works. You know, as a sort of depends what you call it, an investment, or it's never going to be used for money. Like gold isn't used for money anymore. But so
no, it's not if you say gold bars to Sainsbury's, is it? And you know, I guess you could say that Bitcoin. I mean, other Starbucks were running a trial, weren't they, where you could actually pay in satoshis, which are fractions of a Bitcoin, through your wallet.
Yeah.
And I think there are a couple of US states that are actually running experiments. You can pay your tax in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Now, if you think about that, if you're actually allowed to pay your tax in Bitcoin, it's arrived, because then it's seen as a legitimate currency by HM government. Now, intriguingly on that point, of course, we had Christine Lagarde this week of the European Central Bank saying, well, I don't like Bitcoin. It's used for all sorts of funny stuff. Which I thought was a brilliant use of English by a non-native English speaker.
Yeah.
But B was quite interesting that if you look at coinmarketcap.com, I think cryptocurrencies in general have got to around $1 trillion valuation right now. So maybe they're just starting to pop on central banks' radars for the first time. Yeah. And you can understand why a central bank is feeling threatened by that, because in the end, Bitcoin is all about having no financial intermediaries and no central banks and no government interference of any kind. So a central banker isn't going to be too thrilled by that. So I guess in a worst case scenario, what could happen? Well, central banks are already experimenting with central bank-backed digital currencies. Japan, European Central Bank, Bank of England, Fed, they're all looking at it. Loretta Mester of the Cleveland Fed actually talks about opening up a Federal Reserve bank account for Americans and injecting digital dollars into it. But obviously then people will say, well, are you going to tell me where I spend it, how I spend it? Are you going to track it? So libertarians might not be too thrilled about that. So there's some pushback there coming from central bankers already. The crime angle I can see, but money is, you know, it's like saying, well, we're going to ban cars because they're used as getaway vehicles to rob banks.
Yeah, I mean, and it's more traceable.
It's traceable.
Yeah.
And I thought that was intriguing. But again, I guess in a worst case scenario for Bitcoin or crypto fans, is you get the equivalent of Roosevelt's order in the 1930s in the US that criminalized the hoarding of gold. So central banks would try and, or governments would say, oh, actually, you're not allowed to do any transactions in Bitcoin. I think the HSBC are refusing to have anything to do with it. So you could see regulatory pushback, but I don't think that would necessarily stop its value going up, because then you get there's still the scarcity value there relative to paper money. So it would have to be a massive regulatory crackdown, and how they would exercise that, I guess, would also be an open question.
Yeah. And the thing is now, I think right now, we are in dangerous territory, because if you look at something like TUI and Whitbread, they've rallied, but you think, listen, the economy isn't fixed. Like I said, we're rallying on hope and euphoria here, getting towards the end of the tunnel. So, you know the market would have to correct, because earnings are not going to be that good for the next year or so anyway, are they? So it's going to come back a little bit, isn't it? There is about one correction a year anyway, isn't it? I mean, so, we'll see that, won't we?
And I still think to give yourself a bit of safety, you still want to look at companies' balance sheets and cash flow. And Whitbread's interesting in that respect, because it's actually got net cash, but then you have to look at the fact it's got lease liabilities. So it's got net cash optically, but about £2.5 billion of total net liabilities. But it's looking to negotiate the rents down with the landlords, not too surprisingly. But its cash burn is like £20 or £25 million a month at the moment. And it's got £800 million of cash and $1.2 billion of unused debt facilities. So even at 20 or 50, even at 50 million a month, you've got an awful lot of ammo there. You can come through a very, very long downturn in business and still be in business, which I think is the key. So I think if you look, those companies like, Greggs is another one that's roofed it in the last 3 to 6 months, or even the house builders have all roofed it, because on the stamp duty holiday, but people have been able to get out and about in the autumn and look. I think what you're looking for to give yourself protection against these, I would agree with you, inevitable lumps and bumps, is look at companies that have got, or they don't have to have net cash on the balance sheet, but they need to have plenty of financial headroom relative to their existing facilities. So if things get tricky and they can burn, they can just hunker down and tough it out and come out the other side, because some of their competitors won't do.
Yeah, that's it, exactly. And the thing is, I've seen a lot of people who are quite bullish about the opening, and that's quite dangerous. When too many people are bullish, that's a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I must admit, if I was trying to be cute as an owner of Whitbread or Greggs, the day I'd probably look to sell the shares is when Mr. Johnson says actually everything's going to reopen next Tuesday.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
You've all got three, obviously you can't do that, because shops, as we know, retailers have got supply chains. They need to get their staff back on board. They need to get everything cleaned up. They need to get their supplies coming. So it wouldn't snap. But as soon as the Prime Minister says, okay, click, we're touch wood on our way back to normal, we're all going to reopen. And he's already talked about phased reopening anyway, hasn't he? It's not going to be a one and done type thing. But when, in theory, we're all back and out, that, I'd imagine, in terms of points of short-term maximum optimism, is again, if you want to buy on short-term maximum pessimism, then you certainly want to be thinking about top slicing or taking a few profits when we get to maximum optimism. Yes.
And do you know what? That's it. It's the anticipation is the most powerful thing. Like you say, the anticipation of stimulus, that is what rallies a market. When it arrives, That's it. It's priced in. It's done. You know. Yeah. So it's, and that's why fear. That's, you know, when the ultimate amount of fear is happening in the market, that is the best time to buy, because no optimism is priced in, and that's when you get your deals. That's what old Buffett says: be greedy when others are fearful. You know.
That's it. Keep your eye on the VIX index. Keep your eye on the greed and fear index that CNN runs. They have been very, very useful contrarian indicators in the past. I'm sure there's every chance they'll continue to be so in the future, even if, as we know, the past is absolutely no stone cold guarantee that it will repeat itself.
Yeah. Marvellous stuff. Russ, have a nice weekend.
Keep well.
Speak next week. Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five: Shield Therapeutics, down 6.8% to 52. Of course, just talked to Tim there. At four, Alien Metals, non-mover 1.1. At three, Argo Blockchain, 9.36% to 105. Oh, in fact, just changed, down 10% now to 105.5. I assume Bitcoin price is falling, is it? Let's check it out there. Bitcoin, yes, it's down a little bit there. Of course, it moves in tandem with that, the sentiment. At two, Intelligent Ultrasound, non-mover, 15.25. And at one, Brand Shield Systems. Of course, I sent an email newsletter saying I'll be covering this in the weekend video, because I've invested in it and I like it a lot. A very hot area. Of course, brands protect themselves against phishing and all kinds of hacking attempts. And that's why it's a good volume today. But by all means, join my email newsletter. It's free. Just search for it on the internet. Okay, top five most viewed RNSs are as follows. Most read: at five, Shield Therapeutics, business and trading update. At four, UK Oil and Gas, Horse Hill, oil field update. At three, Blue Jay Mining, Inonkovsky JV and exploration agreed with Rio Tinto. At two, Deep Verge, completion of compulsory acquisition. And at one, UK Oil and Gas, government consent, Risan license acquisition. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.